Hello and welcome to the Talking Heads podcast with me, Saul Walker.
And me, Lucy Chamberlain.
This podcast delves into Lucy and I's lives as head gardeners of two private estates in Devon and Essex, as well as casting an eye over horticultural events and our personal gardening passions.
As the daytime lengthens and birdsong fills the air, it means spring is finally here. It's that time of year every gardener loves as another growing season kicks off with a fanfare of daffodils, early blossom and the germination of our precious seedlings.
Every Saturday, we will bring you a new episode on a diverse range of subjects, such as what we are growing, weeding and planting, and news from the gardening world as it develops. We'll also bring you a special monthly bonus interview with some of our favourite gardening peers, discussing their lives and interests in horticulture.
We'd be delighted if you join us down this garden path as we step inside the busy and exciting world of the modern head gardener.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back if you're a regular listener. Hello, the friends of the podcast. If you're a new listener, welcome. Welcome to another episode where me and Lucy, two head gardeners of large estates, chat about our gardens, the gardening life, and what we enjoy. Now, we usually, especially for the last, upteen, which is an official number, podcasts.
It is, and it's in the dictionary.
It literally is a number. Mm-hmm. We usually chat about the weather, but today's podcast is actually probably going to be a lot about the weather.
Yes.
So we're not going to start by opening the
good
weather.
Idea.
What I'm going to start with is asking, what were you doing in your greenhouse when I phoned you yesterday? Because Lucy was in her greenhouse. I could hear it. I could hear the echo in the background. What were you up to, Lucy?
Oh my goodness. It could have been one of many things. Probably sitting there having a cup of tea and a chocolate biscuit whilst the family were away, to be honest. That's the usual thing I do.
What are greenhouses for?
Yeah. Well, these days, they're all art studios and yoga studios. They aren't just your greenhouses anymore. They're undergoing a bit of a revolution. But I imagine I was probably just pricking something out. So, well, I've got seedlings up to my eyeballs in there, seed trays, young plants, there's lots of watering going on. So I imagine I was my ricin trial is doing very nice. I'll talk about that another time. And all my amaranths as well. So I think I did pick out my amaranths the other day. It might have been that you were stumbling in upon.
Oh, lovely, lovely. And have you got to the point, like I am starting to sort of get to, where you are balancing pots on parts of the rafters, in the eaves, on the floor, makeshift trays,
yep,
and all sorts of things.
My heat mats are now being double stacked because the stuff that hasn't yet germinated, that I did sow some French beans last night, actually a little bit late for me, but I've got them in now. They are on the bottom of the heat mat, so I know I've got at least maybe 4 or 5 days before they germinate. So then hopefully by then my tomatoes will be able to be moved somewhere else and the nighttime temperatures will have sorted themselves out. So it's all a bit of a merry dance in my greenhouse at the moment, as it is with most people, I would imagine.
It's those nighttime temperatures. I have still got things...
That's the weather, sorry.
Going
I pertain
on.
To the
I know
weather
we're
there.
Venturing onto the weather, aren't we? Oh, dear. Okay, but we'll just... Nighttime temperatures are the thing that's stopping us getting stuff out of the greenhouse. I've got to say, if it doesn't get warmer soon, I'm really going to have to start maybe even putting some stuff on windowsills... in the
Is
house
Nick
and maybe
approve of that or what, because I think that could almost be a bit of a dispute scenario going on there.
After 16 years of being together, if she's not used to the fact that I've got plants all over the house, all over the garden, in the sink, in the chimney,
in the
on the mantelpiece, then she's probably never going to get used to it.
No, to be fair, she knows what she's let herself into. So.
Well, she's a knitter, so there's wool everywhere. If there isn't a plant somewhere, there's a ball of wool.
Get her to crochet some plant holders. That's what you can do.
But what's that Japanese art where you hang stuff in, like...
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think
crocheted
of the name of it.
It's not macrame, is
no,
it?
I don't know what it is. I'm sure somebody delightful out there will reply to us on Twitter.
Yes, let us know. Let us know on our social media. Yeah, definitely.
Put us out of our misery and our curiosity, because we'd like to know. But that's what Nick should be doing in anticipation of the nighttime temperatures still being stubbornly cold. And then you can join the houseplant revolution that's going on.
I've still got jumpers on, that's for certain. It means I can get out and do things. The wind was bitter on Sunday. We've had high winds. I'm not sure what it's like on the east of the country. In the west of the country, we've had wind coming from your direction.
Sorry.
It was bitter. Fingers crossed, we'll get some higher temperatures soon. But what we want to talk about tonight is not so much the temperatures, but more the amount of moisture that isn't falling on our garden. Because the other thing that April, and I've got to say, if we get to the end of this week not seeing any rain, that has been the whole of April, especially in Devon. with zero rain falling from the sky. I really cannot remember when that has happened last. Last year was warm for about 2.5 weeks, but then we had some quite substantial rains in late April. I can still remember because they broke that warm period. This time, not a raindrop, not a snowflake, not anything. It's been so dry, hasn't it?
I know. It's prolonged. It's just, like you say, it's the length of time. I think that's the thing that's unusual. And yeah, obviously April is meant to be April showers. We haven't had that, but you would expect maybe at some point in the week or within the fortnight for some moisture to have fallen, but there's literally stubbornly been nothing. There's been this northerly wind, and with that high pressure as well, I think, has it been pretty much a constant high pressure? There's been a few fronts coming in, but there's nothing significant enough to shift this away. And that's the sticky situation we're in here, is that it's just sitting there and it won't budge. And it's going to take something to come along and literally knock it off the top spot and then start dominating. What we want is some nice warm air coming up from the south over the land masses, get some moisture in it. Job done. Because anything coming from the east is going to be cold, anything from the north. But maybe coming from the west would be quite nice as well. So, but not the north. We don't want winds from the north anymore. Thank you very much. We're done.
Our rain comes from, well, especially for the West Country, comes from the Atlantic, but also over the Bay of Biscay. Generally, if Spain start having rain, we can almost guarantee that about a week later, rain starts arriving in the West Country, because it sort of travels up the Bay of Biscay on the west of France and then enters the UK. But at the moment, well, I'm looking at my, it's what time is it? We record these in the evening. It's almost 8 o'clock. We got full sun. There's a sunset just about to occur. Lovely sunsets we've been having. It's been glorious if you enjoy dry, sunny weather.
I think that's most of the country.
And I do enjoy it for a week. I enjoy it for a little bit, but not for 4 or 5 weeks in total. So what we want to do is, because we think it's quite timely, is just chat about the kind of methods we use to sort of dry proof. Because I know we talk about frost proofing and we talk about other kinds of proofing our gardens. But I think as the weather is getting, we're referring to it this year, for a good 10 years now, the weather's been getting more unreliable, not as predictable as it used to be. So we'd like to talk about how you would dry proof your garden, both the sort of short term things you can do like now, but also the long term things you might want to think about if the weather continues to prove unreliable as it has been. And it probably will do, with climate change. We'll mention that. I think we are going to have to start thinking more about the kind of ways we grow in our garden and the kinds of things we grow as well. But we'll talk about the long term things towards the end. Let's talk about a few of the things that we're doing right now to help negate the dryness in terms of watering, I would guess.
Well, I mean, for me, because this has come out as a bit of a bolt from the blue, as you say, this is not usual for the month of April. Short term, I actually have been irrigating because I've got lots of transplants out under cloches, a lot at home. I've got some out at the hall as well. The propagator still is bursting, but those that I have put out into the garden, I needed to irrigate. You would have expected by now to have put plug plants, modules out, and for there to have been some moisture. Mm. So, yeah, that has been my short-term method of trying to temper it as best I can, is actually just irrigating. And we talked before, haven't we, about the methods of irrigation that you can apply. If you have time constraints, then overhead irrigation is great. It also freshens up the garden because things have been so dry for so long. It actually gets that lovely kind of like everything's moist. It does make the garden look lovely, which is, I think, it makes you feel an awful lot better. I will mention petrichor, which is our favourite word. We mention it every year. It's that lovely smell you get once you've had a period of dry weather. Normally it's when it's hotter in the summer, but I have had a waft of that a couple of times this year. But there's,
wow, that's so unusual for April, isn't it? To smell that. That is a very June, July, August smell. So in April, wow.
But we have downsides to overhead irrigation. And that's where things like maybe instead you would rather actually irrigate the plants with a hose pipe or a watering can. Because if you overhead irrigate every single thing, then the weeds will grow. And you're also, if you're being really economical with your water, you are wasting water because you need to put it essentially where the plants need it, which is around their roots. Mm. By watering the whole bed, you might be saving time on a big estate if you've got short staff at the moment. But yeah, you are wasting water and you are encouraging the weeds to grow. So there's the pros and cons of doing both. I have done a bit of both. I actually have overhead irrigated at home, purely because my garden at home isn't that big and I don't mind getting the hoe out. It's not too formidable for me. I just wanted to see it looking lush. It was looking so parched and just so, dusty. And I was like, oh, do you know what? I just want it to look a little bit more what I'd expect at this time of year. So at Stonelands, what have you been doing when it comes to this, the short-term methods of remedying this dry spell?
Do you know, as a waterer, I'm very reluctant to start watering on a mass scale, mostly because there's not a huge number of staff at Stonelands. It's a big old place. Mm. And as soon as I do start watering, you know, you have to keep it up. You have to keep it regular or your plants don't appreciate the sort of stop-start nature of watering. Now, yes, we use overhead sprinklers where I want to do mass areas, such as grass, if it needs it.
Like grass, yeah, exactly.
Or our large herbaceous beds, where I know that I use a rotary sprinkler, so when I know the full circle of the sprinkler will be covering and everything that under that will be getting watered, then I feel a little bit more, less like I'm wasting water. You know, if it's falling on hard surfaces or the drive, that's just a waste of water for me. I don't want to be doing that. So, yes, where is a large area, I will use overhead. But for somewhere like the veg garden at the moment, where there's not a huge amount out there and most of it's still sort of establishing itself, I will try and be a little bit more of a spot waterer. So get the watering cans out and water the individual plants, or at least rows. This does two things. Obviously, you're not wasting water on a big surface area where the roots haven't penetrated that much into the soil yet on smaller seedlings. But it also stops you encouraging weeds in between rows and on areas of soil where you haven't planted yet. Because as soon as weeds get just a little bit of moisture, or a little taste of H2O, they will just burst forth. Because you will probably have noticed, actually, one of the good things about the dryness is the lack of weed growth out there, or at least the weeds aren't growing en masse, you know, just a few here and there, making it a lot easier to weed. You put a little water on your beds. I bet you could test this at home if you want. If you've got a dry bed, just make a patch of soil where you water, say, every other day, and you'll be surprised how much more weed growth in that patch compared to the drier area is. So, yeah, I try and do a mixture too, but it is all about time, how much time you have.
It's more labour intensive, isn't it, to spot irrigate?
Certainly is.
Like I say, it's easier to set up a sprinkler or walk away.
One thing I really want to try, and you do this at the East Donlan Hall, and when we were at Alting Wick back in the summer, Philippa and Lou mentioned this, is the seep hose method. Mm. And that is a sort of a length of hose where the water slowly oozes out of pores in the hose. And that sort of applies the water directly where it is needed. Now, I haven't ever tried that before, because it does take a little bit of setup and a little bit of investment in getting it all set up. But I really think that on my herbaceous borders, where I am using the sprinkler and where I have to move the sprinkler around, and sometimes you're not guaranteed to soak all the plants areas. You know, there's always a rain shadow somewhere, whether it's a hedge in the way or a large shrub that the water hits and therefore doesn't get any further. I'd really like to try and get the seep hoses that apply the water straight to the ground. And I know that it works particularly well where a mulch is applied and the seep hose is underneath, and therefore it can get the moisture underneath the mulch, because as much as we've gone about mulches being absolutely the best thing you can do, when it's dry like this, applying a mulch can actually be one of the more detrimental factors that you can do, because it doesn't allow the moisture to penetrate into the soil. It usually penetrates the mulch, but then it acts as sort of a cap, stopping it getting into the soil proper. So I'd like to try that seep hose. I'm guessing you're a big proponent of them.
I am. And I think you touched right at the start about the short and the long-term measures for managing water gluts and dearths. And if you have got a mindset that you want to actually deal with this long-term, then I would say definitely the seep hoses are something to look at. They are an investment, but once that is done, I would argue then the time that your staff or yourself are actually watering the garden with sprinklers or with spot watering is minimal. For example, there's the areas where we have seep hoses at the hall. We've got the hot and cold herbaceous borders. So that's one border that's 4 meters deep. The hot border's about 4 meters deep, about 15, 20 meters long. The cool border, again, 4 meters deep, maybe about 15 meters long. They have got seep hoses snaked all the way through them at about a meter distance. So up and down, meters of the stuff, probably about, at least 150 meters worth of seep hoses there, pegged down with wire hoops so it stays in place. And then that's on the bare soil, and then we mulch over the top of that every year. And then every autumn, when the mulch is sort of like disappeared and you're moving plants around, we then have a look at the irrigation, the seep hoses, make sure it's still working. You do get leaks in there. They eventually do often rupture, either because they've got brittle in time and they've maybe been exposed to the sun, the mulch has sort of eroded away and they've split because of the water pressure, or you can accidentally put your fork through one when the mulch is all over the top and everything's covered up, and then you don't mean to, but with a prong you stab it. Or this is not so much with the larger seep hoses. Ours is about a centimetre in a diameter, maybe 12 mil. But I know from bitter experience with the very small dimension seep hoses, about 4 mil, rabbits loved to gnaw through that. My parents used to have that around the base of their runner beans. We used to go, a good quarter of an acre of runner beans. And also in the tomatoes, if you got a rabbit in the greenhouse, the tomatoes would suddenly get a big puddle because a rabbit had nibbled through. So there are, there's definitely, management of it that needs to be taken into account, but it actually is in the grand scheme of things, it's minimal. And as you say, it's so good if you've got the mulch on top. It's aesthetically then all hidden away. You can't see on earth, that there's anything going on at all. So I am definitely a really strong proponent of the seep hose method.
I definitely want to try and invest in some. Now, I was talking to a friend the other day, and I don't know whether you use these. I don't use these at Stonelands, but I know they use them more in the commercial area, and they're surfactants, or these wetting agents.
It's
a product you can add to water to actually allow them to... I'm not a scientist, but I believe they allow them to penetrate sort of dry composts better.
That's how I know them to be used. Yes. Yeah. I have one of my husband's customers actually was given a surfactant to try as a trial, and she was amazed how, as you say, you've got compost that's got very dry, and it then somehow obviously interferes with surface tension of the water, doesn't it? Surfactants are things that stop the water kind of like forming droplets. There's some kind of science behind it, but I couldn't proclaim to be an expert on it in the slightest. But yeah, she was amazed how the compost was re-wetted. I haven't used them at the hall.
Yeah, I'm quite interested. I might try and go and get some, mostly for use in my containers, especially at home here, where some of them are drying out, daily. I'm out there almost daily at the moment watering. But I have a feeling that to penetrate especially some of the containers which have got a little bit more root bound, that these surfactants, these wetting agents, might actually come in some use. So listen out for a future podcast, because I might talk about those, because, like I said, I've never used them before, and it'll be interesting to see if they actually allow the water penetration to be better. But there's something we could use, I think, or could become in useful.
One thing that I think is quite important as well, we're talking obviously about the most fundamental part of dealing with dry soil, which is actually adding moisture, adding water. So we're talking about the methods of adding water, but also the timing. I just want to touch on that, because I've been finding, especially with these very cold nights, the vast majority of my plants I'm dealing with at the moment are in the greenhouse. We've got some that are in open ground. We've got some philadelphus that we've replanted, some laburnum, some big shrubs. Viburnum's gone into the swimming pool garden. Those are being given a good glug every week. We've got a list of the plants that are new. There's some bare root roses that have gone in as well, for example. I will make sure that those plants in particular get watered at least once a week throughout their first growing season. So that's been dealing with that. But mainly things are in the greenhouse that I'm dealing with. And I'm finding that with the cold nights, it's not viable to water in the evening at all. So or at the end of the day, you can't go, right, okay, it's got to 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, I'm going to water, then go home. Because those plants, they're not, it's not hot enough for them to actually dry out before the evening. And then the cold, cold nights, you know, things, going back to veggies, things like peas and beans, they hate sitting in a cold, claggy compost. They just dislike it completely. So I'm finding specifically that this year, because of the cold temperatures, I'm always having to water in the morning. And I think that can be a difficult thing to manage when you are not actually living on site. I don't live on site at the Hall. We've got a few staff between us that can rotate around to ensure that as much as we can, we're watering in the morning. But it's difficult. I mean, like, say, with Stonelands, for you, I know you're there every day, which would then make that slightly easier, but you've got things like the weekends to think about.
It is a tricky one. And water timing is always a major headache for me. And yeah, related to the weather, related to around my holidays, all kinds of things. And I think when you do work on your own full time, these are the kind of things you have to think about quite a lot. And they can sometimes impact the way you work. You don't always do things ideally. But, you know, that's gardening in general. We never get things absolutely perfect. Just going away from the things to do when it's dry in terms of watering, one of the other things that I think I could sort of recommend now is probably to avoid planting anything just for a couple of weeks. April, and I know we've said this in past podcasts, usually an ideal time to get planting perennials, new veg plants, all kinds of things go out into the garden in April. But actually with the weather at the moment, and not just the dryness, the cold nights as well, it's probably best just to hold off a few weeks and just wait until, and it will happen, there will be an inevitable change in the weather. The temperatures will go up, we'll have a little bit more rain, and that'll probably be a bit more of an ideal time. Things may get a little leggy or a little bit more pot-bound for a couple of weeks, but it's probably better than the plants, like you say, sitting in cold soil, just doing nothing. It doesn't do them any good. They'll be a lot happier just sitting, waiting on a windowsill or a greenhouse.
All my veggie plants are under cloches outside. Not at the Hall, I haven't got the cloches out yet, but all my ones at home here, I've got these glass cloches. I haven't put anything out that's not under a cloche, apart from things like broad beans, which I know are really, really hardy and robust. So.
Yeah, it's worth, if you've got some tough plants. I'll tell you what, my sweet peas are doing fine through this weather.
Yeah, mine too.
As long as I spot water them, they're growing away. So that is good. So that's a few of the sort of short-term things, the things you can do now just while the dry weather's with us. But, you know, what about thinking about the changes in our weather in general? I think this is going to be a bit more of an opinion piece. You know, I believe that our planting palette that we're very used to in this country is ultimately going to have to alter according to the weather, and mostly due to the fact that we are now getting these very intense dry periods followed by intense wet periods. I think we're going to need more robust plants. The plants that I always quote, and these are classic West Country plants, are your rhododendrons and your camellias and your magnolias. You know, that's classic planting down here because they've always responded to the wet, warm weather down here in the West Country. But with these dry periods in April, especially establishing new plants and getting good specimens grown, is getting harder and harder. The amount of times I've been to new plantings in gardens where they've put in a new rhododendron valley or things, and I just see half dead plants or plants just not growing up to their full potential, it's getting more and more. And I do think that we're going to have to start looking more towards places like the Mediterranean, like South Africa, like Australia for our planting palette. Just to get these more robust plants that are used to these swings in climate.
Yeah, we're so lucky, aren't we? We're very, I know you've done travel holidays in Madeira and done garden tours there, and that's described as Goldilocks weather. Not too hot, not too dry, just right. And, in the UK, that is ordinarily what we're actually used to. It's not the extremes, it's the prolonged periods of the same thing all the time. They're very hot, very cold, very dry, very wind, whatever it might be. That's what causes us difficulties with our lovely selection of these plants they just love those sorts of very in the middle conditions. They're not used to the extremes. So yeah, I fully agree with you on that. Another thing that I think is important to any head gardener anyhow, but I think for gardeners, it's going to become such a more important topic to spend attention on, soil management, looking after your soil properly. You know, the key ingredient to make a soil either more moisture retentive or free draining is organic matter, bulky organic matter. So by that, we're talking about composted bark, you know, really, really chunky, rotted down materials that will, on our sandy soil at the Hall, we use that massively to make it more moisture retentive. But on clay soils, you know, like you in Devon, you have to add it there to really open out the soils and make sure that it's more free draining, less claggy. And I think things like, you know, if you've got an area that's prone to waterlogging, you need to maybe think about soakaways more. I've tried trenching a couple of times, and that's been really, really effective. So, for example, you grow, going back to vegetable growing, you've got plants that you know like it quite moist. And so, for example, celery and celeriac, I grow them at the Hall on the light sandy soil. I add loads of organic matter, and I put a trench around the beds, and actually sometimes through the beds, so I know that I can put the hose pipe on there, allow the water to soak, really soak in. That an overhead irrigator or a quick spot water won't give me that real sort of a lot of moisture around the roots. So, and that can be applied to amenity plantings, to trees and shrubs, herbaceous, not just the edibles. But yeah, I do think that soil management is going to be much more important for people as well as the range of things that we can grow.
Talk about soil management, we can go on to water management in some ways as well. I think it's something we have a lot to learn about in this country. I think the occasional small water butt around the side of the house, I know my grandparents had one, and lots of people probably do have, just to, you know, use now and again, just as a sort of catch a bit of water. We might have to change to actually catching a lot more and storing a lot more water at our properties in the future if we want to use water liberally, because the way we use water in this country has been in the past very taken for granted. You know, you'd switch on a tap, water's there. And that may change. And if we want to establish these beautiful gardens, they have been quite water intensive in the past at certain periods of the year. I'm going to be starting to install 3 or 4 water butts here at my home. At Stonelands, we put in a borehole specifically because we knew the property would use a lot of water, and therefore we wanted to use the naturally occurring water that's in the ground. We're very lucky we have a river running through the garden, so that supplies us with water in the water table all year round. But I think people are going to have to start thinking about exactly where they are getting their water all year round from, not just when it's incredibly wet, but actually being able to store that water for use later in the year. And there are a lot of people out there who are doing that with big, you know, 1,000-gallon water butts.
Absolutely. One's underground. Yes. You know, like the aesthetics of it. I mean, domestically, you can buy these tanks now that are absolutely huge, and they live underground. That's quite common in other countries. We've got a borehole at the Hall. The water quality of that actually is... it's interesting. It doesn't actually do the plants quite so well as water that I collect from water butts. But so I you know, there's definitely management of those two environments. If you go to Australia, we've got relatives in Australia. There's no grass as we know it in Australia. Is it Kentucky bluegrass? It's different. It's a much coarser grass that's in Australia. You walk across it. It's not the lovely soft lush lawns that we have. You know, they just can't have that. It's far too arid. And, you know, even then they're irrigating to keep that going. So, you know, there's examples there already in other countries that you can see have different climates to us, that we will just need to take their lead, see what they've done, and apply those techniques to our gardens as well, definitely.
Yeah, I think I was in Australia and I saw this stuff called buffalo grass, which John was telling me about. Really coarse, didn't even look like grass, but very coarse. But it was completely and utterly arid where they were, but this grass was growing quite nicely and keeping their lawns green. Anyway, we hope we've given you some food for thought. Firstly, we hope the weather does break soon for everyone. We do realise that this podcast goes out across the UK and some people have had a lot more rain than others.
I know. Scotland in the north today for us have had a lot of rain.
So if you would like to send some down this way, we'd be quite grateful.
Yeah, blow hard, would you? Send those clouds down to us, please.
Yeah, blow hard. But We hope that the rain breaks, but we also hope that you're starting to think about how you're going to manage these dry periods in your garden a bit more and just using the water wisely.
And that brings this week's episode to an end. Whether you're a new listener or one of the podcast's friends, we hope you enjoyed listening in on what we had to say. Please do let us know as well, either through a review with your podcast provider or direct to us on our Twitter feeds, at Gardening Saul and at Head Gardener LC.
As spring unfolds and the gardening season progresses, we hope to bring you along on the sights, sounds and essential work that we are getting up to while we curate our marvellous green spaces. If you're a new gardener, welcome! There is not a better time to get some soil under your fingernails and join this thriving garden community.
As head gardeners, all our work over the winter months is beginning to pay off in spring. So as two committed and enthusiastic friends, we hope you will join us every week to hear us chat excitedly about the gardens and industry we work in. It really is one of the best jobs in the world.
So until the next episode of Talking Heads, goodbye!